Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
For June 25th, 2023. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have you on tonight. Let me set up the show. Here in about 20 minutes, we're going to have joining us for the second time, Dr. Charles Whelan, economics professor at Dartmouth. The last time we had Dr. Whelan come on the show, he talked to us about a just fascinating travel book, kind of a memoir about traveling with his family. He's written other books as well, traveling through around the world for a year. But tonight we're going to get a little more political. He actually started one of the co-founders of Unite America, a national organization trying to bring people across the political aisle together. I don't want to steal too much of the thunder of the mission because he can explain it vastly better than I can. But he's going to talk to us about Unite America and their goals and mission and just bipartisanship or efforts in America. So that should be good here in about 20 minutes. But until then, Tim and I are going to discuss an international issue of the day, or the weekend, I should say. The sub dominated the first half of the week's news, and the second half of the week's news was dominated by an effort to overthrow Vladimir Putin in Russia. It appears that the effort has, I guess, didn't fully reach its goal, but I would not call it a failure either. Tim, tell us what you can.
Well, wow, a lot happened, and you know, nobody expected this either. All of a sudden, the Wagner Group, probably 35,000 troops, and their leader here, they came over into Russia, and one of the first things they did was occupy the southern military headquarters, the place where they actually are prosecuting their war in Ukraine from. And he did it. The reason that was given by Prigozhin, the head of Wagner, is that his troops were bombed by Russians. There's been a lot of yeah and back and forth between him and senior military leadership in the days leading up to this. We knew it was testy, but nobody saw this coming. And what was stunning, David, was the ease with which they did it. They basically took that headquarters I was talking about in a major city in southern Russia without firing a shot. Next thing you know, here they head up the main highway toward Moscow and taking cities and villages along the way with very little or no resistance at all. They were welcomed by the people. You saw on TV a lot of rock stars or something by the average Russian citizen. They wanted to take selfies with them, do all this stuff. And they were within 200 miles of Moscow, and the city was locking down, setting up checkpoints, putting out troops, extra policemen. They were getting ready for what appeared to be a street fight. Vladimir Putin he had gone on television and denounced, the whole of Wagner as traitors. And next thing you know, the president Lukashenko in Belarus says he brokered a deal, stopped it. Prigozhin announced his troops were turning around, and Prigozhin's going to go into exile, and criminal charges against him and soldiers are supposedly dropped. there we are with a lot of questions and very few answers, David. What do you think?
I definitely think there's more answers. I did hear about Fergusian. Apparently, back in 1993, he was involved in a coup attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev. So you're kind of like, well, I don't know what to think of him as an individual. I mean, I know Putin, who he is, and obviously Gorbachev was a much more forward-thinking elected official than our leader, I should say. Their politics gets kind of tricky in who was elected and who actually wasn't. But Gorbachev was a more of a good guy in our way of thinking than certainly Putin. So it's like, well, where does this guy stand, you know, philosophically? We don't know. It could have been just another, you know, power-hungry leader trying to take power in Russia. But the fact that they were able to just rip through the Russian mainland shows you, I think, how stretched the Russian army and really Russian people are and where they stand. So I think the implications for Ukraine are pretty important in that war. Honestly, the biggest winner out of this whole thing may be the leaders of Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, because it really shows how weak the Russians are, wouldn't you think?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of questions. I mean, what of Putin now? Is he weakened by all of this? What will his allies think? You know, what are they going to think in China and North Korea and places like that? And what you alluded to, what of the war in Ukraine? This can only be seen as a disaster. Russia simply is no longer a top-tier military or economic power. Now, they have nukes, plenty of those. I guess they're online and work. Who knows? But that's about it. As far as the military we used to think of, the old Soviet Union, that's gone. As far as a power broker amongst, you know, they're behind China now. They're second tier. They're just going to have to admit that. If they want to go along with China, they're a follower of China. They're no longer on equal footing with China or with anyone else. And so you got to wonder what's next for Vladimir Putin. And I'm going to tell you, Prigozhin, you know, we know Vladimir Putin's history, David. Prigozhin, I heard an expert say this morning, if he's in exile and he's not surrounded by his troops who can protect him and stuff like that, this expert gave Prigozhin 60 to 90 days to survive, because that's the way Putin operates. The man's cold-hearted, and you know, he just he will not respond well to this. There's going to be a lot more. This was the opening salvo, and there's going to be more coming. We'll just have to see. But this was earth-shattering.
Yeah, I think I saw a quote that was back from like the 19-teens. It may have actually been Vladimir Lenin that said it, like, in Russia, you'll have decades where nothing happens and then days in which decades happen. And it really feels like things move pretty quickly.
Well,
in their,
it's also, if you've ever seen the television show Game of Thrones, a recurring theme in the Game of Thrones, if you attack the king, you kill the king. And that did not happen here. They attacked or started an attack on the power structure in Russia, and they stopped and turned around. Well, you know, Putin's not the sort of guy that's going to say, well, that's okay, just don't let it happen again, ha-ha. No, you know, that's not the way it goes. There is going to be some bills to pay by somebody on account of this. And I guess the next thing we see is where does this go with Ukraine now?
Yeah, that's the kind of part that I'm more interested in, because I just get the sense that, you know, the Russian people are going to have to topple Putin. I mean, it's going to be more of a groundswell than just this group and this one leader, because I really don't, like I said, I don't know his motivations. And so I'm kind of leery given his history. But if it forces Russia just to give up on Ukraine, possibly, I mean, I already heard that there was part of the Crimean Peninsula that the Ukraine retook for the first time in, you know, years since that first invasion years ago.
Yes.
And so that's really significant, showing that they're going to push out. So they may end up getting, you know, the whole of their Ukrainian land back, Putin out. He then has to figure out his own survival in his country. I mean, I've heard that you did have a lot of deaths of despair in Russia among the male population before this war, but this war has just accelerated the decline of the male population, in particular in Russia. Obviously, even if you have a decline of male or female population in your country, that's not going to be good for your long-term growth prospects. But if you are a country who wants to wage war and you see military as being a male-dominated endeavor, that's really bad for you.
Yeah, and, you know, on the political front domestically, you know, a lot of our military and civilian leadership in Washington, D.C., you know, spent a rather nervous weekend. Let's don't forget that Russia has 6,000 nuclear weapons. If that country were to suddenly, and it was close, were to suddenly destabilize and anarchy break out, what then? You know, what happens then? 6,000 nuclear weapons. Are some of them going to disappear? Are some of them going to end up in even more unfriendly countries? We have to think about things like that. Would what replace Putin be even worse than him? So we had a lot to look at, and I'm sure that all of Europe spent a nervous weekend as well. What is next.
All the NATO leaders, you know, had an emergency, you know, kind of teleconference with folks meeting and all that. I thought when you said domestically speaking, I did see that, you know, Donald Trump took this as a chance to defend Vladimir Putin, which would be to the surprise of no one. But then more disturbing in a lot of ways. I saw, I just happened to, because I don't watch as much cable news as you do, but I watched a little bit, I think it was just yesterday or last night, and Jim Acosta had the congressman from Knox County that we talked about a few weeks ago, Tim Burchett.
Right.
And he said, and he started really kind of defending Russia in a way, and he said, you know, about like our involvement, we're giving arms to the Ukrainian people. He goes, I just don't think the American people for that. It's just too close and too much like Vietnam. And I'm like, how in the world do we elect people to Congress that actually don't understand Vietnam, don't understand what's going on in a current war? And this guy was on the Foreign Relations Committee.
See,
or just so so deceitful they're just going to sell nonsense to their people because that's what Donald Trump thinks.
A couple of disturbing things are associated with that. Now, according to that NBC News poll that you sent me part of earlier today, 52% of Republicans in this country do not support our involvement in Ukraine, which might indicate that, and you know, if Donald Trump were to take over again, that would end our involvement in Ukraine. What would that mean? Well, we spend about 5% of our military budget, that's all, on helping to arm Ukraine. But that 5% translates to 50% of Ukraine's military stuff. 50%. Without it, you know, guess who's going to win that war? We can't allow that to happen. Why can these people not understand that? Why can these people not understand that, no, Vladimir Putin is not our friend? You know, former KGB agents are not friends with the United States. This man wants to reconstitute the old Soviet Union, and he means to do it by any means necessary, including violent means, including invasions. He's already showed that in Ukraine before and in northern Georgia and some other places. And, you know, we need to stay where we are. We need to support this country. We need to put a stop to this right now because Putin will not stop. Why can they not see
the old saying? Yeah, the old saying, partisanship ends at the country's borders, ends at the ocean.
Yeah.
This, we're getting to the point where we're so partisan, we don't even agree on simple, what should be simple things like Putin is bad and what he's done to Ukraine is, you know, out of bounds of domestic, you know, the way you conduct international policy. Well, let's go ahead and switch gears because obviously there are far more astute people to discuss these foreign relations than we are. All of this makes me want to have our friend Joseph Lindley on the program again sometime, hopefully even late in the summer. But let's get back to our buy-sell-hold. And we, like we said last week when we talked about Chris Christie, these folks keep getting in the race. We keep having to discuss them. I am not going to go in, like, chronological order because, honestly, I would have to make my own timeline to keep up. But I'm just going to start off with the mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez. And before I actually get to Francis Suarez, let me welcome into the Kudzu Vine, Catherine Smith. Glad you could join us, Catherine.
Hello. Greetings from Atlanta. Sorry I'm late.
Yes. Well, we're going to go ahead and talk about buy-sell-hold on Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. And so he entered the race, and I have heard some interesting backstories about why he has actually jumped into this race, so we may get into that. But, Tim, Francis Suarez, mayor of Miami, a fun, vibrant city down there at the southern tip of Florida, buy-sell-hold on Mayor Francis.
Gee, this guy voted for Hillary Clinton and for Andrew Gillum. Toast sell.
There's so much more there, though. Catherine, buy, sell, hold on him.
Sell. He doesn't have a chance. But tell us some of the backstory. I don't know any backstory about this, so I'd like to hear what.
Okay, let's go ahead. I mean, obviously, it is such a long shot. Even if he didn't have these intriguing, you know, wrinkles and backstories to his campaign, I would also sell him. But I do want to tell you, I've heard that even though he voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, he has actually been encouraged to get in this race to help Donald Trump. And you mentioned, Tim, that he voted for Andrew Gillum in 2018 against Ron DeSantis. He is getting in this race to hurt Ron DeSantis. They had, their feud is much more deep and visceral, and so that's why I've been told that he's getting in the race to siphon off some Florida support from Ron DeSantis to where it would weaken him further. Now, I don't know that all this is even necessary. Ron DeSantis is doing so poorly. It seems like a bit much. But it does make an interesting story. I'll be honest, you know, I went to Miami back in January, and I know a little bit of Miami. I was kind of surprised at a Republican mayor, but I get the idea he's not the average 2023 Republican. Miami seems like a much more cosmopolitan city. I think they're very gay and lesbian friendly. You know, they're trying to recruit tech industries down in Miami that may be a bit misguided with climate change, but they are trying to do these things. Those are not pillars of the salt of the earth Republican Party.
Yeah, but David.
What, David, look, let's be honest here. Let's be forthright. He's going to go to Ron DeSantis voters and say, you know, instead of voting for Ron DeSantis, vote for me. Yeah, I voted for Hillary Clinton and you know, for a Democrat for governor of Florida, but how about it, Ron DeSantis voters, vote for me. Who? No, never.
No, I don't see where he gets his groundswell of support. I mean, to me, this does layer more into the confusing and interesting and complicated question of what is going on in South Florida with particularly Latino voters down there. Let's go ahead. Y'all keep discussing this fact, and I'll check on something on the producer side.
Okay. You know, Catherine, you agree with me, don't you, that, I mean, this guy, he doesn't act like a Republican. He doesn't sound like a Republican. We know the types of Republicans we're talking about. They have the same hardcore Republicans in the panhandle of Florida that they have, you know, up here in North Georgia. And this guy,
all right.
I'm trying to think of him getting 10 votes, aren't you?
Yeah, and also this idea that he's doing it to help Trump. Trump doesn't need any help in Florida.
No.
Right now.
And he's not going to pull DeSantis voters away who are almost like Trump voters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, DeSantis is going after the same vote that Trump's going after. And none of those voters are going to be very interested in Francis Suarez.
Exactly.
If David is not with us.
Yeah, no, I'm Tim. I am back, and I'm excited to bring back onto the show for the second time Dr. Charles Whelan. Welcome back, Dr. Whelan.
Good to be with you.
Yes. Well, we know last time we had you on, we talked about your fascinating a travel book, a memoir in a way, about your family's year-long vacation around the world. But we knew you had more political and other writings as well to discuss. And so we want to get you back on to talk about your founding of Unite America. So tell us about the organization.
Well, it's been a long story. I guess I'll go back way to the beginning. So I am somebody who's a policy wonk at heart. My training is in public policy. I have a master's and a PhD in public policy, so we sit around and talk about whether the inflation measure for Social Security is accurate or not, things that most people don't care a whole lot about, but also health care and lots of other issues. But I have an interest in politics because politics is how you do public policy. And I founded Unite America first, which was called the Centrist Project, mostly because I had the sense that our political institutions were not solving our public policy challenges.
Yes. And so the organization's been around a good many years and has a quite a staff. In the last few years, you know, our politics continues to get more and more contentious. How has that kind of caused your organization to evolve and face, you know, caused you challenges?
Well, we need a theory of change. If you're going to try and change policy through politics, you got to have some way that you think people are going to behave differently. And I would point out that what we're concerned with is not one side or the other. We try to be nonpartisan, so there are issues, policing and right now some of the gender issues and abortion, where people have very strong points of view, and it feels a little bit like if one side wins, the other side loses. But there are other issues like the environment, fixing entitlement programs so that they last, making health care more affordable, where we just need to make some progress. And so our theory of change is we need to build some kind of connective tissue that allows our politicians to behave in ways that are more conducive to solving problems.
Yes. And I was going to ask you one more question about Unite America. I'm probably going to come back in and ask some other questions in a bit. But as I was looking about your board and organization, I noticed that you had added recently former Georgia Congresswoman Carolyn Bordeaux, onto the board. And I know she has that little bit of bipartisan credential. She's a good Democrat, but she worked with Republicans in the state House to achieve some, you know, budget measures, I think, that actually helped education, maybe more at the higher level. So tell us about how you brought her in.
For exactly that reason. She was somebody who was committed to problem solving, has a clear point of view, obviously, but doesn't let that get in the way, and was very frustrated by how the system was working and felt that what we were trying to do is consistent with what she's trying to do now that she's no longer in the House. And so she was a natural fit for the organization. I will say we had a board meeting a couple weeks ago. It was the first time I met Carolyn in person. It was terrific. It was also really interesting. We were at a dinner to see her sitting across the table from Jason Altmaier, who's a former Republican member of Congress, and they had a tremendous amount in common. And so that's what we try and do, is bring together people who want to solve problems. But they tend not to be on the extremes, because those folks are not necessarily the bridge builders, but who are the people who can build a bridge in ways that allow us to get intellectual traction on issues we care about?
So what I'm hearing is you're not going to be the person to solve the rift between Marjorie Taylor and Lauren Boebert.
No, I'm gonna be the guy saying stop looking over at dumpster fire, and because it's just that, you know, nothing good is going to happen over there, certainly if you care about healthcare policy and infrastructure. I'm saying look at over here, at, you know, there are 435 members of Congress. Let's look at the 250 who might actually be able to work together, and not look at the 10 or 12 who seem to get most of the airtime.
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass it to Tim. He'll pass it to Catherine. I do have some questions about bipartisanship or partisan rancor or what have you, but not the actual organization. Tim?
Oh, good evening, Dr. Whelan. Thank you for being with us again tonight.
Good to talk to you.
Let's just start at the beginning of this country. A lot of our founding fathers were not in favor of political parties. So should political parties exist now? Aren't they part of the partisan problem?
They have certainly become part of the problem. There's no doubt about that. And your first point is also worth noting. Not only were there no political parties in the Constitution, people are shocked that they weren't there at the creation. Political primaries are not in the Constitution. Those are a relatively recent phenomenon. And I would argue that primaries contribute to a lot of the problem. But Washington warned about factions in his farewell address. The Federalist Papers warned about factions. So if I were to put a benevolent spin on parties, I would say they're good for organizing people. They're good at broadcasting our views, mobilizing people to action. But when they become tribal, which is how they are now, where if you say the world is round, I'm just going to say reflexively it's flat because I'm in a different tribe, then it becomes a deterrent to actually governing a country.
Now, when addressing election reform, which would you say is more effective, legislation or, say, ballot initiative?
It depends entirely on the state that you happen to be in. We're fighting on both fronts. One of our big theories of change at the moment is that primaries are a big problem because it combined with gerrymandering. So we've got so many gerrymandered seats. So there are all these seats with boundaries drawn by state legislatures to advantage whatever party controls, and both parties are merciless at it when they happen to have control. So they draw these safe seats, and everybody recognizes that. And then primary voters go and pick whoever controls the seat. The primary determines who's going to hold that seat in Congress. But what we forget is that that means that there's no general election battle, and the winner of the primary is effectively the winner of the election. Well, primary voters don't look like most American voters, and so you tend to get more extreme Democrats, more extreme Republicans. Those people then go to the House, and they know the only way they're going to lose this safe seat is if they're challenged in the primary by someone in their own party who's more extreme than they are. So if it's Democrats looking over their left shoulder, Republicans looking over their right shoulder, which means that there's no incentive, and in fact there's quite to doing the kinds of things, particularly compromise, that they're required for legislation. I mean, if you had primaries and social media and C-SPAN and MSNBC and Fox News at the time of the Constitutional Convention, there'd be no compromise. We, you know, we'd still be in Philadelphia, or we would have crumbled.
Mm-hmm. So, one thing you mentioned that I too favor is independent redistricting. You know, independent commissions or whatever. But realistically, is it possible to convince partisan state legislatures to give up that power?
It's really tough because the party out of power, of course, is all in favor of it because they know that the boundaries are being drawn to their disadvantage. But then as soon as they're out of power, so they can't actually make the change. And then if they manage to get back into power and you read to them everything they've said about anti-gerrymandering, suddenly they walk it back. We actually saw this in Virginia, where I believe it was the Republicans were in power. They were gerrymandering. The Democrats said this is terrible. Then the Democrats managed to win a majority, and suddenly they were thinking gerrymandering might not be so bad. But, and this is, I think, part of our mission, there was a bipartisan group of legislators who were saying that gerrymandering is bad regardless of who's in power. And they managed to hold up. So the Democrats in that coalition, even when the Democrats held power, stuck to their word. And Virginia got, I don't know exactly what their mechanism is, but something that is more in the direction of independent redistricting. But your point is a good one, which is if you control the power, nobody's going to relinquish it voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one more generalized question, then I'm going to send it over to Catherine for some more questions. And I'm sure you've been asked this before, but there are many in this country who would say that although the efforts of a group like yours at moderation and nonpartisan reform are noble, they really have no chance of success in this highly charged partisan atmosphere that we're seeing in this nation right now. What would you say to those folks?
I would point to Alaska. Alaska is one of the most interesting and, I would argue, encouraging cases in recent years. So in 2020, when all eyes were obviously on the presidential race, Alaska passed a referendum to get rid of their partisan primaries and replace them with a single open primary. The top four finishers, regardless of party, advance out of that primary. So everybody gets to vote, Democrats, Republicans, independents, and the four people who advance could be three Democrats and a Republican. It could be two independents, a Republican, Democrat. Top four get onto the ballot, and then the winner is selected by ranked choice voting. And that had an immediate and powerful effect the next time people went to the ballot. So in 2022, we saw a number of things. The first is that Sarah Palin didn't win. And I don't think it's an anti-Sarah. Well, it's not an anti-Sarah Palin thing. It's not an anti-Republican thing. But Sarah Palin is one of those folks who's relatively divisive. There's kind of a ceiling on her support. And so what happened in ranked choice voting, there were two Republicans and a Democrat in the final round. The fourth candidate dropped out. A high proportion of the people who picked the other Republican as their first choice picked a Democrat rather than Sarah Palin as their second choice. That tells you a lot. It means that you get a winner who has broader support. Now, in that same election, Lisa Murkowski, Republican senator, was reelected. And she had voted to impeach Trump. So in a red state, when the whole state is voting and she doesn't have to run a Republican primary, she gets reelected. So arguably that's a reflection of what Alaskans want, not just primary voters in the Republican primary. And then at the same time, Alaskans elected a relatively conservative governor. So, he campaigned in a way that got broad support. So you have a range of outcomes that I would argue all kind of push in the direction of giving better voice to what the entire state wants instead of just the small, highly partisan folks who show up in a primary in a gerrymandered district.
Well, I thank you for that excellent example and analysis. And with that, I'm going to send it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. It's
good to
great
be with
to
you.
Have you on the show again. I read some of the things that you've written, and I applaud the effort, and I think it's great, and I wish you every success, but I'm just really curious about how, I mean, it's got to be, we've got to look at this in very, very small steps, right? Because there's, like we've all said, it's so contentious right now that how do we, I mean, what's your vision of how we actually move this forward and accomplish what you're talking about? I might just be, you know, jaded or something or too old, but it just feels feels so tight right now that but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'd say I'd say three things. One is you're not wrong. I mean, as somebody who's old enough to have been around for a long time and spoken to a lot of politicians, it is worse. It's not your imagination. I've spoken to I play golf with Judd Gregg, who's a former senator from New Hampshire, relatively conservative guy in an old New England kind of way, and he used to write legislation with Ted Kennedy. So they overlapped not much at all, but when they did agree on something, they'd write legislation because they were both there to govern, and if they disagreed on the other 97%, well, then let's leave that for tomorrow. There's 3%, let's act on the 3%. So we have lost that capacity for now, which is quite dangerous. I guess on a more encouraging note, I would say, look, there have been other dark periods in the United States, the 60s, the Depression, World War II, Civil Rights Movement. And I think there's some truth to what Winston Churchill said, which is, you know, America always does the right thing after it's exhausted every other possibility. And so, you know, and so I don't know, I keep thinking we've hit bottom, but maybe not. You know, I do think that the country has it in us to do right, but it's just not our first impulse. So it requires an effort. And then I think I would say that your point is correct. It takes baby steps. And we think of kind of three overlapping circles. Is it impactful? So if we were to do this, would it actually make a difference? And that's true of a lot of things, campaign finance reform and so on. But then we kind of overlay the second circle, which is it achievable? So can we actually get it done? And that takes a number of things off the table. Like, I don't think we can do campaign finance reform in a world where Citizens United is the current law. And then the third circle is it bipartisan, which we don't want to do something that inherently in the long run advances one party over the other. And so we think that independent redistricting, which has come up, ranked choice voting, making primary elections as broad as possible, these are steps in the direction of electing more people who have more interest in governing as opposed to grandstanding, scoring political points, and so on.
Okay, well, I agree with you. All but primaries. I always look at primaries as the party's opportunity to select their candidate. And I've never really been in favor of open primaries. I've always resisted the impulse that some people have to switch parties from their natural party to vote for the opposite party because they're trying to finagle the results to get either a worse candidate that's going to be easier to beat or a better candidate who, if they win, won't be so bad. It's one of those conversations that we have, you know, with friends who say, well,
let me agree strenuously with there, because I think that's just, first of all, I think it's just kind of disingenuous, but I think it's terribly dangerous, right? You have the party saying, look, mm-hmm. this candidate, the other party, is so terrible that we're never going to be. Well, what if that so terrible person actually gets elected?
Yeah.
What I always say. That's absolutely what I say.
I don't think you ever can honestly vote for somebody because you think they're the worst. Like, it's just not the way the world is supposed to. Maybe I'm naive in there, but I just think that's a dangerous game to play. I mean, I think under ranked choice voting and open primaries, parties can still get together and say, all right, four of us are all Democrats, you know, Bob's going to be the one who runs, the three of us are going to support Bob. There are things you can do privately as a party to maximize the chances that you elect somebody who shares your views. But I think the big problem with primaries is so many voters are effectively excluded from picking the person who is ultimately going to represent them. If you're in a gerrymandered district, your primary doesn't matter, maybe. Or if you're an independent in a state with closed primaries, you just get whatever two candidates happen to show up on the ballot. So I think there are a lot of ways that are not optimal about how we put our choices on that ballot that we could fix and probably still protect what you like about parties, which is, look, we believe in certain things and we want to organize ourselves and improve the chances that we're represented.
So then what happens with conventions where, a party does select a slate of candidates that they're supporting? I guess it doesn't really have an impact on that.
Well, you've been doing a lot of it. For example, California's got top two primaries. They don't have partisan primaries anymore, so two Republicans could run against each other, two Democrats could run against each other, and so on. That's after the primary, so a bunch of people run the top two advance, whoever the top two vote-getters are. But you could, if there were three Republicans, you could get together and kind of agree that only one of you is going to run, or if one of you is not doing well, you'll drop out and endorse the other two. And there's nothing stopping people who share a point of view from collaborating. You just want an election that allows the participation of the most voters and is likely to produce a winner who has an incentive to solve problems. So in the case of Alaska or California, where you got to go back to all the voters, not just to your primary voters, I think that you're going to do things in the legislature or in Congress that are more consistent with what all the voters want. I think it's about fixing that incentive imbalance.
I guess I can understand that. I absolutely agree with you on ranked choice voting, especially in a state like Georgia where we have runoffs. So we If you don't get 50% plus one, then 2 months, whatever, a few weeks or sometime later, we have another election, which costs a fortune
for the state to run low.
And the turnout is terrible.
Right, ranked choice voting is effectively an instant runoff. That's another way to describe
right.
it. You put your first choice, your second choice, your third choice. People are knocked out. Yeah, it's a much more affordable
and I
way.
I do think that over time, it does improve the contentiousness because if you're running and you're like, you have something in common with one of the other candidates, like you agree on certain values or issues, you're going to be careful not to slam them too much because you're counting on their voters to vote for you second.
You might even say something nice about them. I mean, think about
right.
that. I'm running against Cindy. I think I'm a better candidate, but here are the three things I really like about her environmental policy, which is unheard of in the current
right.
environment.
So I really am excited about these ideas. I've been around for a long, Tim and I have been around for a long time and have seen a lot of ideas come and go, but I'm really hoping that you have success and I'm checking y'all out and keeping an eye on it and wishing you all the best. I think it's really great.
I'm going to say there's a little contagion effect. So Alaska passed ranked choice voting in 2020. In 2022, Nevada did a nearly identical reform by Citizens Ballot Initiative. And that question came up earlier. In a lot of states, the legislature doesn't want to touch this because the status quo is what got them elected. But some states are more amenable to ballot initiatives than others. Nevada passed it. So if their law is you've got to pass the same referendum in two consecutive cycles, so they got to pass it again in 2024. But both the Republicans and the Democrats opposed it, and yet the population passed it. And so if we can get it passed again in 2024, then Nevada will look just like Alaska. And, that's two states,
wow.
a very different kind of state. It gets easier. You learn how to message it. People watch it work in Alaska. So that was very encouraging.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'll have to look at that. Thanks so much. This has been very informative and very helpful. Go ahead, David.
Yes. Well, Dr. Wheeler, I did have a question about the No Labels campaign. Now, obviously, your group's not involved, your organization's not involved with them, but they've made a lot of news because people fear they may be a spoiler, if you will, and they're not been real transparent about their funding. From what you've seen and read and heard about the No Labels organization, what are your thoughts on them and their efforts?
Well, there's some things about what they're doing that I like a lot. So, for example, they have created the Problem Solver Caucus in the House. So it's an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. They meet together. It's one of the few bipartisan organizations that's actually continuing to function. And so on. I like the spirit of that. I think the caucus has not been as effective as it could be. They could get together and affect the outcome for Speaker of the House. They could change the rules. There are a lot of things they could be more powerful about. But I like the idea of working, creating this bipartisan working group in Congress. And a lot of the members of Congress whom I really admire have been members of the Problem Solver Caucus. I am very concerned about the possible presidential bid that No Labels talking about getting ballot access for the potential third-party candidate. And yes, because of the Electoral College, it's extremely unlikely that a third-party candidate is going to win. And if he or she doesn't win, then, as you know, if they deny one party or the other majority, it goes to the House. Right now, I don't really want the House picking my president for all kinds of reasons. I'm not sure I ever want the House. I mean, even the framers said the House was going to be kind of the hot-headed institution. So I think it's a bit of a dangerous game. They're correctly gauging that America wants better options. If we think this is going to be a replay of Trump versus Biden, you've seen the same polls I have. Nobody's excited about that. But the rules of the game are the rules of the game, and a third-party candidate could give us an outcome that is not what most voters want.
Yes. Well, we'll continue to watch them. Go ahead, Dr. Whelan, before you leave us, tell our listeners how they can kind of access and learn more about Unite America.
It's really simple. We're at uniteamerica.com, or .org, sorry, and it explains what we're trying to do, our various campaigns around the country. We work a little bit like a venture capital fund where we are a funding mechanism and a source of support for groups that are doing really interesting reform work at the state level. So the Alaska referendum that I spoke about was kind of a homegrown effort, but we certainly created a lot of support for that. Same in Nevada, fundraising support, messaging support. So if they go to Unite America on the web, they will find us. And hopefully they'll be inspired to think that there is some path forward that's better than what we're mired in right now.
Yes. Well, such a fascinating discussion, and we know that you'll be following the political races and goings-on of the House and Senate moving forward. And you've also written other books we've yet to discuss, so we'd like to have you on again in the future if you're so willing.
I would love to come back, and hopefully next time we'll be talking about another win in another state, and everybody will feel a little more optimistic.
That'd be
great. That would be great.
Thank
you,
great,
sir.
Right? Yes.
All
thank
right.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Dr. Charles Whelan, economics professor from Dartmouth and one of the founder of Unite America, author extraordinaire, just a great guest. And if you hadn't listened to his travel book, it is very funny, but also very insightful and entertaining. We got probably about 12 more minutes, so we got enough time. I think we can at least get through one more of our buy-sell holds. We probably gave Francis Suarez more airtime than he's probably gotten in a lot of other venues, but we're going to move on to former Vice President Mike Pence. He has been kind of circling around the shadows of running for president, and in the past few weeks, he finally, I guess, made it pseudo-official where he has a website and can raise money and actually do electioneering activities. And so Mike Pence, he's been asked about in every poll. Never seen Ken seem to get in double digits. I believe he was 7% in today's NBC poll. But he is running. And Catherine, buy, sell, hold on Mike Pence.
Oh dear, I think I just have to sell him. He's just so boring. I can't I can't imagine him captivating enough voters to have any impact on the race in general. I don't see a path for him to have any juice. So I'm going to sell him.
Catherine, you say he's so boring, but I haven't watched him, but I heard there's a series of movies called Magic Mike. I just thought that was the Mike Pence story. Am I wrong?
Not close.
Thought about something different. Thought about Mike Pence, Magic Mike. I mean, you know, I don't know. Well, Tim, buy, sell, hold Mike Pence.
Well, I mean, you know, have to be realistic. I mean, the man's a rock, real conservative Republican, you know, in the tradition of Reagan or somebody, I guess. But look, he and a handful of other candidates are vying for the votes of perhaps one-third of the Republican primary and caucus voters in this country. I think Pence has a chance to finish third nationally. Unfortunately, David, third place is going to be at about that 7% mark that you noted moments ago. Have to sell him.
Yeah, I'm going to sell him as well. There was a constituency for Mike Pence in the past. You know, a few weeks ago, Pat Robertson passed away. I don't know if we even got to talk about it much. But that constituency that they had developed, I guess he and Jerry Falwell and some others had built this religious conservative voter. And Mike Pence is very much cut from that cloth. And if we were still in, say, 1995, you know, 1988 for that matter, you know, Mike Pence may have a better chance. But in the meantime, the religious right has probably shrunk a little bit. Part of it has become kind of convoluted. I think our guest over a year ago, Dr. DeMay, when she talked about how there's now this muscular Christianity where it's not the same, you know, even evangelical Christianity that it used to be. Those kind of folks may even gravitate more towards Donald Trump, even though that is bizarre when you think about what they should stand for and what Donald Trump stands for. And then also, I think a lot of the new voters that have come into the Republican Party, while they're probably the kind of folks that probably drink out of a coffee mug that may have a, you know, Bible verse on it, they're not necessarily the kind of folks that go to church every week. They're religious, but they're not practicing all the time. And that's more, you know, Mike Pence's wheelhouse. So the demographics of the Republican Party are not in his favor. He is not very exciting. He wasn't very exciting as vice president. And then let's finally say one more thing. A lot of the Republican base hates him because he didn't just basically try to steal the election for Donald Trump. He followed the Constitution. He followed the law. He listened to former Indiana Senator Dan Quayle about doing the right thing. Glad he did the right thing. Kudos for him for doing the right thing. But it sure ain't going to help him in the Republican primary. And I just can't see him getting to the next level to even speculating what a Pence-Biden race would even look like. Let's see if we can get through another one of these folks. And we got the North Carolina governor, the North Dakota governor running. There was another – I think we had four candidates that we could have possibly covered. Well, I know we won't get all four. And Will Hurd, that's the other one. I want to talk about Will Hurd. We got about 6 minutes. Former Congressman Will Hurd, and it's so funny, we actually talked about him. We're going to talk about him on the day that we had Charles Whelan talking about bipartisanship. And to me, Will Hurd is one of those bipartisan faces where people could actually work across the aisle. Tim, buy, sell, hold on Will Hurd's candidacy.
Oh, I want to buy or hold him so bad. He's he is that type of Republican that you
just mentioned, and they are really, really, really an endangered species now in that party, and it's really sad to see. And I, before we went on the air, I asked you a question. I'm going to ask it now. The question I would ask of Will Hurd is why? Why are you running? Because he's a smart political guy. He's got to see that barring just something incredible, he probably doesn't break 5% in any primary or caucus. And so I'm forced to sell him.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and let Catherine buy, sell, hold, and then I'll answer maybe. I really can't answer why, but I'll answer some things about Will Hurd. Catherine?
Yeah, I have to sell him. I agree with you both that, you know, he's the kind of Republican that we sort of long for, but
mm-hmm.
no one knows who he is.
He's, mm-hmm.
you know, it's an uphill battle for someone with poor name recognition as well as values and history that is contrary to the sort of general opinions of the Republican primary voter. So, you know, maybe next time someone like him can have some influence. But right now, I think you got to sell him.
Yeah,
because he's not even a viable vice presidential pick, because he would be in constant conflict with, you know, whomever, you know, whether it's Trump or DeSantis or whatever. It wouldn't be a good pairing.
Yeah, I think we've told exactly, you know, we've told the tale on him. Catherine, you said he's the kind of Republican you like. Tim, you talked about how much you like him. I listened to his book, Reboot. I wanted to have him on the show. I was never even told no. We tried to come to a date with his people. We still may get him at some point. I really like him as a Republican, too. I think he actually is a problem solver. And that's why you have to sell him, because us three staunch Democrats think so highly of him. And so that's why he's signing. And he's not. It's not like a Republican saying, oh, I love Tulsi Gabbard or I love Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, because they're just a, you know, I don't know what the end game is there, but he's not that. He's just somebody that's kind of middle of the road and will talk about problems in a real way and look at solutions. I don't think he's always going to agree with us on everything, but he's going to tell the truth on things. What I would like to see happen is I'd like to see, and it may be after the 2024 election, is if President Biden sat down with a Republican and said, look, we're going to really talk. If you want to really talk about immigration, we'll really talk about immigration. I'm going to set up a commission. I want to be bipartisan. And to show you how bipartisan it is, I'm setting it up as a Democrat, but I'll make Will Hurd the head of the commission that will start talking about this and looking at the issues, because Will Hurd really has good issues. He says, you know, all this build the wall and all this nonsense is silly. He goes, if you actually want to keep people coming in legally and not illegally, you do more stuff at the actual checkpoints with facial recognition, and actually talked about how you would keep people from illegally crossing at the actual checkpoints, because that's really where a lot of people come through. They come through actually legal points and just aren't, you know, detected in the right way. So it is going to be an interesting campaign. If he actually can get on to some of these conservative news sources and just be who he truly is and talk, he may serve a purpose, because maybe some of these Republican-leaning voters hear something different, and it kind of opens up their minds and broadens their horizons. And so that could be the most valuable thing out of his candidacy. But at the end of the day, it's not going to be a winning formula. Guys, I know we hadn't talked about North Dakota governor. There may be more folks to come in. But honestly, for me, the reason I have to sell everybody is because nobody's going to beat Donald Trump. Do you see that changing, Catherine?
I don't see that changing.
Tim?
No, and that goes for DeSantis, too. The polls keep showing he's not going to beat Trump either.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I mean, I if you said who's the front runner for the Republicans in 2028, I'd say, well, until something changes, I'd say Donald Trump.
You know,
they can't quit him for anything. Well, guys, we are having a summer break. We've talked about this, and we do have our next show set up. I'm so excited because we're going to come back from that 3 weeks off on July 23rd, and Simon Rosenberg of the Hopium Chronicles, that's his new endeavor on Substack. He's still out there really getting great information. Simon Rosenberg is going to come on the show on July 23rd when we reappear after, like I said, a summer hiatus. But until then, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first